I was thinking about something that's just incredibly real for all mass shooting researchers is I know what we do in the way that we talk about this will or will not contribute to whether this happens again. That is a real thing.
All right, punters, this last week for everyone has just been absolute chaos. And if you've, you know, been directly impacted, or I think all of Australia has been impacted by what's happened in Bondi. From my own perspective, I had podcasts planned. I had, you know, different topics that I was going to explore. But then obviously in the wake of just a horrific terrorist attack, it's just, you know, everything gets put into perspective. And honestly, the conversation online has depressed me thoroughly. And my journey with it all was I just tuned out. I just went, you know what? We don't know enough. I'm just going to tap out and check in tomorrow and give it a few days and check out. But I kept on thinking, there's so many different things to focus on. In what ways can I offer value to the people that follow Punters Politics, which is normally every day it's funny, satirical criticisms of government and policy that we can all kind of understand a little bit better to make policy better. When I don't know what the bloody hell's going on, I look for just people who study this stuff, people who spend time looking into it, and I just look to try and learn from them. And I personally tap out from that news cycle that just gives me little pieces of information more and more and more. I don't feel any more informed. I feel, you know, like it mesmerizes me. It captivates my attention because there is so many things to be outraged about and so many heroic stories to focus on as well. That's why I'd like to introduce to you, punters, a new Puntermon of mine, an expert in the field, Puntermon Glyn Greensmith, who is someone who spent many years studying mass shootings and journalism and the intersection and exploring the conversation of what the bloody hell do we do? Do I do? Does the media do? What responsibility do we have in these situations when professionals and police are doing their work in the background? But what's our role in this? So, Glyn, thanks for joining the Punters on the Punters Politics podcast.
Mate, it's really good of you to have me on. I follow what you do. I think it's great. I'm a huge fan as a journalism educator of people using the creativity that's out there to engage in important stuff. And you're a really good example of somebody who just so often looks beyond the bullshit politics of any situation and says, well, what's really going on here? And, you know, a word I get from the way that you communicate with your audience is thinking about our own responsibilities and our own agency.
One thing I noticed when I just tuned online briefly, what I saw straight away, and it's honestly what I feared straight away, with horrific scenes like this, there's just heightened emotions and mass opportunity to leverage whatever the bloody hell has gone on for your own political game, for your own political agenda, for your own talking points, for your own foreign government's agenda. Didn't take bloody seconds before foreign leaders were coming in and hitting our politicians and our politics and trying to tell us what to do. And I just got, that's kind of what I got sick of sort of seeing. And it made me just ask those questions like, what is it that we should be doing in the aftermath of situations like this, which thankfully is more rare in Australia than somewhere like the US, but clearly it doesn't look like it might stay that way for long.
We are impatient. And in a situation like this, which is thankfully, as you say, incredibly rare in our country, it's okay to want to know what's going on. But what we mustn't do is transfer that into, like, I have a right to know what's going on right now. And then there are no rules. Because I'm hungry for information, there are no rules. That's just not the case. And what we need to be a bit better aware of is what is the right natural order of things that can contribute and help in a positive way in a, in a nightmare like this. I was like everybody else. I mean, this is my field. I was in shock, and shock is a powerful emotion. I was sad. I was scared. I was worried. I was thinking, what is about to happen? Who's going to do this well? Whoever does this well will make this country more safe right now. Whoever does this badly will make us less safe. So at the same time as I'm thinking and feeling about what was going on in Bondi, at the same time as I was thinking about what do I know, I was thinking about something that's just incredibly real for all mass shooting researchers is I know what we do in the way that we talk about this will or will not contribute to whether this happens again. That is a real thing. It is a real thing. And so when we talk about the coverage of this, when we talk about the conversation around this, I'm not happy to tell you this, but I promise it's real. It may be whether or not it happens again. And I can tell you that there were people out there working really hard to communicate information in a way that makes us safer. And there were people out there communicating information in a way that has made us less safe as a country. And I don't want to preach fear. I don't want to do a terrorist job for them. But these are the elements that we should be considering when we're thinking about the nature of, yes, the way that we report it from a traditional news sense, which is very much my field, but how we talk on social media, how we respond as a community. What I would say to all of you is you actually have a lot of power in the way that you choose to respond to this, with what you do and what you say on social media, with what you choose to believe, dear God, with what you choose to share, and whether it's a real thing, whether it's a deliberate lie, whether it's an accidental lie, whether it's a piece of hatred. I mean, you mentioned right off the top that some people seem to just immediately leverage this this tragedy for their own aims. Can we take some time and think about what kind of word we would use to describe somebody who would do that? Yet I'm not seeing a lot of accountability for the people that were standing up before anyone knew anything and laying blame and clearly on the grift. That is despicable, and we should say so.
I don't know what my role in all of this is. I don't know what just me as a regular punter, me as someone with a platform, what's media's role? What is Australian society's role? There's a direct community that's been impacted, and then there's people that the ripple effects go out like endlessly. What's the difference between mass shootings and other disasters and other things that happen? And how is it that the media's response can feed into making it worse or better or making us more safe or less safe?
The random mass murder... there's random mass murder and there's acts of terrorism. And often it takes us a little while to work out which is which, but we've seen both. So Port Arthur, we would classify as a random mass murder. Christchurch, we classify as an act of terrorism. So there's two Australian shootings. We're pretty sure that we're dealing with an act of terrorism. It's been declared an act of terrorism, and there's a process that the police go through that. But these things take a lot of analysis, you know, to fully determine. The act of random mass murder doesn't exist in human history. Like, humans have always killed each other. Humans will kill each other for anything, for a bit of land, for a bit of food, for a shack. Humans just have always killed each other, and there's been mass murder events. But the idea of the random mass murder was actually incredibly rare. But from a shooting point of view, it began at the beginning of the last century in America. The second one was about 1903. Second one was about 10 years later in Germany. The third one, by the way, Melbourne. Melbourne Botanic Gardens in the early 1920s was the third ever mass shooting. And what happened was these crimes happened they sort of increased a little bit, maybe about every 4 or 5 years globally, there would be a mass shooting event of some description or a mass murder event. Every 4 or 5 years, until the 1st of August 1966, at the University of Texas, a guy pulled his gun cases up to the top of a tower, got his rifles out, and just started shooting people. And he shot a lot of people. And all that happened that day was the news, you know, the television news was pretty new. And there was a bit of competition between the networks. And they were looking for ways to make this a good story for television. So they weren't sitting in a room being evil. They were like, how do we make this an interesting story for TV? So they changed the way that they talked about this crime for the first time. And they focused very much on who the perpetrator was, you know, and how exactly the crime was committed. And they asked a question that they hadn't really asked before in any meaningful way. They said, why did this happen? How do we determine why this happened? And in doing so, they went through childhood photos of the killer and put them out on the telly, and they talked about whether he was suffering headaches or was schizophrenic, and they just went through his life and they put it on the telly. Before the 1st of August 1966, about one mass shooting every 5 years. After the 1st of August 1966, 15 a year. Immediately, the only thing that changed from those two dates was the news. So we say that that was really the birthday of modern mass shootings, because the only thing that changed was the news. And that script that we wrote that day has kind of been the same ever since. If you turn on a mass shooting from the US, who is the killer? How did he do it? Why did he do it? Here's his Facebook posts. Here's his manifesto. Here's his diary entries. Here's his home videos. Here's everything we can find out about the killer. Here you go. Let me dip it on there. There we go. All right. Do we all know why he did it? Great. Good meeting everybody.
In this case now, there's just footage of this dude just loading, barrel loading.
They've been showing footage of the guy just doing his,
just
living his
just
life.
Just unloading it, like it's Call of Duty sort of thing. Like he's on the battlefield. Like, and I've seen that. Just every time I open social media, I'm seeing the clip, not even just a photo of the guy now, but like a moment of him mid-heat just firing bullets.
So the truth is that I realized as a journalism educator that all of the people who study mass shootings were saying that the news was at the heart of it. But no one had ever taught me that. You know, I worked at the ABC, I had a postgraduate degree in journalism. I'd become a journalism lecturer before I'd ever heard that there was this whole body of evidence saying that the news is why mass shootings happen by and large.
Right.
And so I dived in, you know, and I was like, Jesus, this needs looking at. So that's the fight that we've been having across the world. And there's been some successes about saying, if we change the way we report this crime, we will reduce the number of these crimes. It is 100%.
Why is there that direct connection that seems so obvious between the before the news media change and after?
The only example of random mass murder in history is a phrase that you know, and it's called running amok. You've heard that phrase, right?
Yeah.
Like if kids trash the room or the dog does something, oh, they're running amok, right? You've heard the phrase? And it actually is a real thing, and it came from the Malay Peninsula in the 16th and 17th century. And it was actually first discovered by an outsider, by James Cook, of all people. He was the first person to record, like, what is this thing that is happening in the Malay Peninsula? And so the British and the Dutch were the colonial, you know, overlords of this whole area. So we're talking about Malaysia and Indonesia, that whole Java area in the 16th and 17th century. And amok was basically when a man who had felt like society had neglected him, or he'd been dismissed, he'd been ignored, he'd been called a coward, perhaps. He felt he'd lost his honor. And what he would do is he would grab his knife and his spear, his Chris knife and his spear, and he would go into a public place and he would kill as many people as he could until he was killed. And in doing so, he thought he was regaining his honor. And there was a really specific reason why. They had this tiger demon called the Hantubelian. Okay, I might be not pronouncing that perfectly. The Hantubelian. This tiger demon could infect you and make you murder people. It was the demon that made you do it. It wasn't you. It was the tiger demon. But the kicker was that the tiger demon, the Hantubelian, only possessed the bravest, the truest and the bravest. So any man who felt disconnected, any man who felt like he wasn't getting the respect he deserved, who felt he'd been abused or insulted or called things, all he had to do was murder people. And then he literally, everyone would say, wow, he was really brave after all. We didn't realize what a heroic man he was. So this amok thing, Punter, was huge problem, massive problem. They couldn't stop it. How could they? They had the weapons and they had this motive. They had these men who felt disconnected from their society and had a way of changing that. How they stopped it was the British colonial masters trained the local militia and soldiers to capture these men alive. Don't kill them. They want to die. Then when they captured them, instead of like executing them, they started putting them in these new things called insane asylums. Now, these insane asylums were a place of deep shame in that area. They were like, we don't like this place. It feels, you know, the juju's really off. So they changed the story. They changed the outcome that the killer was expecting. If I do this, I know you'll talk about me like this. And they took that away. They changed the story. They changed how it was reported, right? Guess what? Stopped it. It went away. This thing that couldn't be stopped, this thing that had no end because of access to weapons and just in the impossibility to predict it, went away because they changed the story. So the example, the only example of mass murder in human history like that actually has the way we report it at its heart. And honestly, not much has changed. I went through 100 years worth of mass shootings. The only time I can find a clear motive that's been assigned for so many of these crimes is when the killer has said, when you see me on the news, you'll know who I am. When the killer has said, it seems like the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight. Or in acts of terrorism like Oslo and Christchurch, where the killers said, if I kill loads of people in a spectacular way, I know the news will distribute my manifesto for me. So these killers have said, it is not the act of murder that we're interested in, it's the outcome you're going to give us. And we reckon about 9 out of 10 mass shootings might fall into that category, which means if we think really clearly about impacting the outcome they're expecting, we could potentially stop 9 out of 10 mass shootings. That is a fight worth having. And it is incredible, this historical analogy that still applies today. You talked about one of the guys there, and you know, they may turn out to have radicalized connections. But honestly, having studied 100 years worth of mass shootings, if the answer isn't the answer that already was given by the younger of the two killers, I'll be surprised. What did he say to his workmates? I just want to be remembered. That's what he said. After 6 months of all the evidence and whether they were connected to terrorist groups overseas and whether they did go to training camps or how they got guns, that might be the answer. That might be it. They had hatred in their hearts. They felt disconnected from their society and they just wanted to go down in infamy. It's too often the case. So all I talk about with this is if we remove their expectation, we may stop the crime. If we change the story, we will change the crime itself.
Like, there's so many different facets to this, and by no means, I guess, you're not saying, like, this is the only way to stop mass shootings, because obviously Australia versus America, they have way more solo, lonely dude mass shootings in schools, hundreds a year, and we have zero, because clearly taking guns, making guns not readily accessible is very helpful in limiting the amount of people that someone can kill. But now we're going to, like, obviously in the aftermath, it's like, what do we do? What can be done? If people who are committing these crimes are looking for attention, then now we're talking about media, because that is the machine by which everyone looks at something. And there's this, there's that moment when atrocities happen and all, like, it doesn't happen anymore. All of society now looks at one thing. Like, back in the day, everyone would watch Australian Idol, and you don't realize that now no one watches the same thing. Everyone's watching something different, and there's not these mass moments of everyone kind of culturally doing the one thing at the one time. Like, Christmas is another thing when everyone's doing one thing. It's very rare, and the media is the distribution mechanism, and they're telling us what to focus on. They're telling us what we're all looking at. They're speculating. They're essentially setting the narrative, and then there are people trying to set the narrative for their own gains after that. So it is interesting for me to explore, like, where, because I'm half in this role, like, I'm on the internet, I have a following, I can point at least 500,000 people to look at something pretty sort of easily. So this is very interesting for me to look at as I go, what am I pointing at? And a question I have is, what's the difference then between mass murder events and extremism and Islamic extremist or any religious extremism that drives people?
Wrapping themselves in a flag or a cause is often a means to an end. You know, they say they're doing it for religion, but they're not. They say they're doing it for a cause, but they're not. You know, last week was the anniversary of the Sydney siege. Do you remember the Lindt Cafe siege? And that dude, you know, he held these people hostage. He had guns and there were TV cameras there. And then he got a black and white flag that looked a bit like an ISIS flag and he put it in the window of the cafe, right? Double the number of cameras turned up in the next hour. I'm sorry, I live in the news. I don't think it was twice as newsworthy. And by the way, guess what? No connection. No connection to that group, but he wanted to drape himself in something that he'd seen a lot on the TV. He knew that was spectacular. And the news went, yeah, you're right. Like, this is twice as interesting to us now. Those innocent lives that we're talking about are now twice as interesting. It's like, well, no, they're not. They were interesting already. These are still innocent lives. So the wrapping themselves in an ideology is usually a mask to hide their own patheticness. It's usually a mask to hide the fact that these are cowards who have become disconnected and are seeking to create something for themselves that is not that. Even if this turns out to be an example where they are connected to an organized group, it is just so often the case that they're using that in the way that every religion, you know, has people who say, my religion's about peace. And then other people who say, yeah, so I'm going to kill everybody who disagrees with that. And we're in the middle, like normal people are in the middle going, is that really what the Bible says or the Quran? I don't think it is. I think they're just saying that. So they're searching for their tribes. They're searching for their connections. They're searching for respect. They're searching to be less pathetic. And then they're embracing their evil side, their cowardly side, and committing these horrible acts. So seeking to just have a bit of nuance in how we understand that would, in fact, help us be better. I mean, this is a huge conversation in our society about loneliness generally, disconnection, division, all these things that we're feeling, men and women. But we're talking a lot. It seems to be men that are feeling this more, and a lot of them, you know, here we are in an online environment, making their way towards some of the worst human beings in the world who are so clearly on the grift, and will just make them hateful and more divided. But they're finding tribes, they're finding connection, they're finding some elements of self-respect within that. These are complicated problems in our society that we should be tackling and thinking about and helping us reframe these mass murder events, taking away attempts at justification, you know, people's attempt to use, oh, it's a political cause. No, it's not. You don't care about that political cause if this is what you do with it. You know what I mean? You've made every Muslim in this country less safe, and you know you have. So you don't care about that. Taking away religion, taking away all of those things they attempt to hide within, which is the truth of themselves, which is the running amok. You know, that just the idea that they want to be respected and seen as heroic in their evilness and their destructiveness is so important for us to embrace and understand. And it will help us get better at finding ways to tackle these genuine problems in our society.
For some reason, I just think the internet will lose its mind over hearing that it's, because what I'm hearing from you is that it's these disaffected individuals who then go looking for a cause to be relevant and then find an extremist cause and therefore commit the cause in the name of the extremist cause. They have the manifesto. They have like the bloke in Christchurch, clearly not Muslim, had his manifesto, whatever. I never saw it, obviously, and is looking to further his political cause, I guess. And when you say to people, well, the political cause doesn't matter. There's something deeper going on. The political cause is the front, it's the veneer. And when we report on the political cause, we're kind of playing into their hands. Is that?
Yeah, yeah. So the Oslo killer in 2011, okay, as a right-wing murderer, he killed 77 people. That's a lot of people, mostly young people. He survived and was interviewed. And in his interviews, he said the deaths were just the fireworks. They were the fireworks so that the media would distribute my manifesto for me. So what he was saying was those people didn't die because what was in the manifesto. Those people died so that the media would send it out for him to say, well, this seems to be why he did it. Do you see the difference? And you're right, it's subtle. But when you actually connect to it, you go, holy hell, that is so powerful. The Christchurch killer, who, by the way, was Australian, I really don't think I think we did a bad job in 2019 of not realizing that he was Australian and saying, what's going on with us that we grew and exported this guy who slaughtered 50-odd people. The last thing he did before he went into the mosque the first Moss. The last thing he did as he sat in his car with all the guns and everything ready, his little GoPro, was he got on his computer and he emailed his manifesto. And he emailed it to some politicians and everybody else, news outlets. That was the last thing he did before he slaughtered innocent human beings. They were telling us as directly as they could, we're doing this because we expect an outcome from you that we want. And I'm saying in all of these cases, be they right wing, be they, you know, Islamic, be whatever, is understand what their intended outcome is and disrupt it. Because every time this happens, we say why and we think about what it means for us. But at the same time, it's our responsibility to say, I don't want this happening again. And we everything we do now contributes to whether this happens again. So we can disrupt the messages that potential other killers get. And it matters. So, you know, you'd be too young to remember Port Arthur. It certainly was before I lived here. But it'll be 30 years next year since Port Arthur happened in 1996. I'm friends with a brilliant retired forensic psychiatrist called Paul Mullen. And he has analyzed possibly more surviving mass shooters than anyone else. He's the guy who sat next to the Port Arthur killer in his hospital bed. He'd been burned because he set the house on fire. He intended to die, but was too much of a coward, so he ran out of the house in flames. The police were going to shoot him because they were pretty angry, as you would be, but they didn't. And he survived. And that was pretty interesting for us because we got to learn some things from him. He was obsessed with the number of people he'd killed. He wanted to know if he had the record. He was a very dumb man. He had like an IQ of 66. Like, I mean, dumb in that sense. You know, he's dim. He wasn't psychotic. The only thing he really knew about was other mass shootings. And all he kept asking the police was, what's my number? He wanted to know where he stood in the pantheon of mass shootings, and the police wouldn't tell him. And he was going, getting really angry. So this guy, Paul Mullen, he sat next to this killer and said, why did you do what you did? And what we learned was everything I'm talking to you about. He had a hope and an expectation of how he would be talked about. But something really interesting happened in Australia. We said no to that. Like, we did not give him what he sought, by and large, in the media, and certainly in our public conversation. In fact, you know, I used to work on ABC Radio, Ponta, and I used to have a radio show, and I'm not from here. My now wife was at the ABC as well. Long before I was an academic, I was on the radio. I can't remember why the subject came up, and she said to me, you know, you never say the Port Arthur killer's name on air. And I'm like, oh, I'm in Western Australia. Why? She said, I'm just telling you, if you say his name on air, you watch your phones light up, you watch your texts light up, and people will say, don't say his name. People did that. They did that here. They said, F that guy. Don't use his name. And I was really interested in that. I was like, oh, that's so fascinating. Now, I think it's mind-blowing. I think what she was pointing me towards was that Australia made a decision that you do not get what you want. I think Paul Mullen thinks that is every bit as important in the fact we didn't have mass shootings anymore as gun control. And I'm not joking when I say that. Every bit is important. We changed the story. We disrupted a mock. Then, from about 2018, there's been about 5, 6 mass murder events in this country, and we've changed the way we've talked about them. So 2018, there was a family killing in Western Australia. 2019, there was a shooting in Darwin, and there was the Christchurch massacre, which I very much classify as an Australian example.
Yeah.
2022, was it those, you know, sovereign citizen Wiambra killings?
Yeah.
2024, the Bondi stabbings? 2025. Mm. Oh, and there was a Melbourne car ramming, if you remember, about 6 people killed in that. So mass murder events don't have to have guns. So we've actually seen an increase over since 2018. And since 2018, I've been noticing very, very carefully that we don't use the Port Arthur example anymore.
Mm.
We don't reject them. We don't say you will not get what you want. I'm sorry to say this. It's not a coincidence that this has come back to our society now. It's back. And I'm worried. I'm worried that it's back, and I'm worried that it might get worse. And that's why when I say what we do now has an impact on what happens next, I really mean it. And that's for all of us. Like I said earlier, what we share, what we choose to verify, our hot takes, our politics, like we can all contribute to say we don't want this happening, no matter who it is and no matter how they want to do it. We can make a choice to say we don't want to go down that path.
Which I think it is depressing, but also helpful to think, what role am I playing? However small part am I playing? And it is depressing because when, like, let's talk about media now. Let's talk about Australian media. Let's talk about the Bondi mass murder. Because when I look at, like, I have heavy criticisms of media in Australia. And largely I use words specifically when I'm talking about and making skits or whatever it is. It's, I use the word corporate media. And then there's mainstream media, but you know, what's mainstream now? Joe Rogan's got more listeners than the ABC. So is he mainstream, right? So I use the word deliberately corporate media. And when I look at the corporate media structure, for me, that's media that is for profit. And it makes me so depressed because when I look at media now, if your business is to make money in media, in news, this is the greatest time for you. Everyone is watching everything you put out with bated breath because we want to know. You're in the responsible position of telling us what's going on. Are we safe? Who should we worry about? Who are the heroes? What are the stories? The incentive structures of our corporate media cut against everything I'm hearing you say, because if they take a leaf out of your book, well, that's not I want to know. So I'm going to flick to a channel where I do know. I'm going to find out. And that's where the eyes go. That's where the ad dollars sort of go. So I'm looking at the incentive structures of how our media operates. And I'm not surprised to hear you say that it looks like there's been a change in how we cover these events, because it just so happens that the way that we cover the events now, well, it looks like they'd be getting way more profit because of the way they cover these events. And because it's so disconnected and abstract, it's really hard to get people on board with what you're saying. It's like, but I want to know. I'm allowed to know these things. Why shouldn't I know the guy's name or see the guy's face or whatever it is? Yeah. You've laid out a really good case as to why not. A really good middle finger to that, to anyone who wants to do that. The middle finger is, we will not look at you. We will shun you. We won't say your name. We won't see your manifesto. I don't want to know anything about you. I want to know the victims and the heroes of what brings us together. But media, our corporate media, the profit model doesn't seem to move that way. Is that, am I being overly cynical as to when I look at the media, what I'm seeing?
As a journalism educator, I can't make the subject of media ownership and business models more sexy. I can't. It's dull, it's distant, but at the same time, I cannot make them less important. Like, they mean so much. When we talk about media as a mechanism for profit, you know, the news, that's not what the news is for. Like, that's just not why we exist. We invented the idea of corporate media as an element of diversity. When it was invented, yes, there were powerful moguls who influenced government just like today, but we never really understood the impact of selling advertising and how it would actually change what we thought news was. So it wasn't people necessarily sitting in a room being evil, but what we haven't done is redress the balance. So if we think of somebody saying, well, the most important thing is our ratings because that's how we determine our advertising dollars and that's how we pay for everything, then I say, then change the way you pay for everything, because the news matters more than those advertising dollars. If the advertising dollars are changing the way you do the news in a worse way, then change the way we pay for stuff. Let's find a better way to pay for stuff. Because when you talk about creating the nature of a story through the prism of how much you get to sell a 30-second advertising spot to Harvey Norman for, then you're saying that's what truth is worth. You're saying that's what life is worth. You're saying that's what Australia is worth. You're saying that's what democracy is worth. You're saying that's what we're worth. And we've got to be worth more than that. And not only have we sold so much down the river in the name of this, we've done it on the cheap. Like, can we also be a bit less cheap about how we sell? Like, so what is truth worth? Is a genuine, legitimate, it's not a philosophical question, right? I literally mean, what do you think reality is worth if I asked you to give me a dollar sign? Because right now it ain't worth shit and we are selling it. We are selling it. We are rejecting it.
the news determines what our reality is, and we sell it to the highest bidder, and often to a foreign billionaire that have their own interest that decides, this isn't profitable to be part of Australians' reality right now. So let's not cover that.
One of the things I like about your channel is that you talk about these things that underlie the politics of our society, which is like the headline stuff. Oh, we're all talking about immigration today or net zero. It's like, oh, actually, well, they're saying that, but what are they doing? Are they enriching themselves? Are they changing the law to make it easier to lie, cheat, and steal for them and their mates? And that's like, no one should like that. I don't give a shit which party it is. We've got to look after democracy as well. And that's the area we all need to realize we sit together. Politics is just the stuff that appears at the top of that. And that's the stuff that's so hard because that's the stuff that feels really distant for us all, I think. How do we change the structures of politics? But it comes, and you know, you think it's such a spider's web. How do I snip over here but get the whole thing? Largely, they get away with it because we don't ask. Like, we do not ask them to be any better. And I just think we should definitely ask our leaders to be better than they are. I don't have a very high opinion of politicians in this country of all stripe. I'm very fair and balanced. I hate them all. And the structures of democracy, I think if we all sat together in the pub and talked about what we think, you know, how you would build a democracy from scratch to work for us, we'd pretty much all agree on the most important things. And the opposite is what's going on. And it's too big, it's too much, it's too far. Journalism and how we fund it, how we decide who gets to own it, why it matters, it's a reasonably straightforward question. But we don't ask it because the Prime Minister doesn't want to ask it. He doesn't want to tackle the big media companies. He's trying to keep them on side. He's got his opinion pollsters saying, oh, no, you be nice to Rupert and then you'll get better with this demograph. And then they're all off. And Channel 7's naming the wrong killer again. I don't know how many times you're allowed to do that as a news organization before somebody goes, should we stop? Should we not do that? We did that at Bondi the first time. We did that when that little girl was kidnapped in Western Australia. We named the wrong. Can we not? Can we recognize that's not what news is and say it doesn't matter how fast we are and our responsibility is more than it? And you made the point. I mean, I don't know. Would you, if you were watching, say, Channel 7 and they were going, right, we're going to verify this information. We're going to let you know what we know. Would you go, oh, no, I'm turning off and I'm going to find a news channel that's giving me all the bullshit that I want? I don't think people do that. I think they're just like, this is the news channel that I watch or this is the newspaper that I read and I'm used to it and I will wait for them to tell me stuff. They're not flicking around looking for lies and nonsense. So we can slow down a bit and talk a bit more about what we know. Speculation isn't news. Speculation isn't news.
You say speculation isn't news, but that's all I see when I turn on the news. And I think when I look at the media, and maybe this is why, you know, we'll get into social media in a little bit, but this is why people are turning away from established media and corporate media is because I feel like there's no honesty there. Like me personally, what I want to see is everything you've said, but from a news presenter that says, we're not naming this killer because we do not want to give in to his demands and we're not showing you a photo of this person and we're holding off. Other news outlets might have shown a picture. We need better verification before we send someone, we misidentify a shooter to some other bloke, innocent bloke who's now going to get death threats or whatever, however life he's in danger by being misidentified. Like, there isn't that level of authenticity in the media that we're seeing now to like talk to us like adults and tell us, hey, we could say this, we do know this, authorities know this, but we're not broadcasting it. And we think that it's better if we as society come together and just kind of ignore these details and know and focus on something else instead. But we kind of don't get that. And it just seems to me when I'm watching the media, I see one channel looking over at the other one going, oh, shoot, where are they? Okay, what are they doing? No, we've got to be first. We've got to be first. Drop it first. Is it right? I don't know. We'll correct it later. Next, moving on. Like that's what I'm seeing just from how they report the news. But they do it in such a serious way behind the desk with the thing. And it looks super legit. But I'm seeing more authenticity from people on YouTube than I do from the corporate machine.
So I have been shown from really inspirational news leaders around the world that this message has taken hold. even here in Australia. So we had the MEAA change their code of conduct after Christchurch, and the ABC. They both tried to talk about not elevating a mass shooter. There's been a bit of a switch in this last year. Australia has been very mixed. So we've had the MEAA and the ABC saying, let's be an SBS, let's be really mindful and ethical. And we've seen some of our commercial media outlets. Christchurch was a really good example of a really bad example. You know, we're going to go all in and give the killer everything he's asking for because we think this is a pretty interesting and sensational story. So here you go. Here's everything we can find out about the killer. So it's mixed. There's very little mass in the media. One thing that's happened since our friend Donald has come back into our lives is in America now, whenever there's a mass shooting, everyone wants to know which side he was on. What we're seeing from Sunday is a bit of a concern that we're so divided down political lines. People just obsessively wanted to say it's Islamist or it's, you know, leftist or it's Nazi people are rushing. And in America, they're undoing a bit of the good work that they've done to say, okay, we're not going to give the killer everything he wants, but we're definitely going to find out who he voted for.
So when you look at how the media reported the Bondi terrorist attack, how Australian media, like how would you grade it? What would you look at? What's your take on that?
Mixed grade. So some places have done really well. I full disclosure, worked for the ABC for a long time. And by and large, I thought they were great. You know, they do focus more on the victims. And I think we were, I don't know what the word is. The fact that Ahmed al-Ahmed exists and did what he did and got captured on camera, the fact that we found out about Boris and Sophia Gurman gave us easy ways to say, yeah, there is a better story here, isn't there? There are people we should be talking
powerful
about.
Stories.
Incredible people, people who much better represent who we want to think we are than the evil cowards who committed the crime. So I think that's so powerful. I promise you, every mass shooting has those stories. You know, there are incredible acts of humanity and courage in every mass shooting. And we've spent so long missing them. I think we're better at seeing them now. And I think that's great. You know, and commercial outlets were doing it. Everyone was doing it and talking about the heroes. The flip side is, you know, why did they do this? Is a really valid question. We're all asking that. But the moment we say, why did they do this? Of course, we don't know yet. So here's everything we can tell you about the killers. Bang, you've just walked into the problem. You have absolutely driven into the wall. The moment you say our job is to tell you everything we can tell you about the killers in an effort to try and define motive, when you have no idea, it is just speculation to link here's everything we know about the killers to motive, except that wall that you drive into is the entire body of evidence around mass shooting research saying this is why. Like, this is why. So even the ABC, you know, I saw one article saying here's everything we know about the killers.
Yeah, I think I saw that too, yeah.
Yeah, and that hurt my heart because they did so much good stuff. It's not, again, it's so important to separate malintent from, you know, from this. It's not people saying, let's do the wrong thing. They're like, this feels like something important. We want to give people information, especially in an era of disinformation. I understand that it's complicated, but that it's also incredibly simple. 9 times out of 10, the motive you seek is what you just did. 9 times out of 10. If they are not, if 9 out of 10 mass shooters, and this is a great stat from Paul Mullen, who interviewed so many surviving mass shooters. 9 out of 10 were not psychotic when they committed their crime. It means 9 out of 10 are doing it for a different reason than psychosis. If you say, here's everything we can find out about the killer, I promise you, you are probably walking into what the motive is.
So then let's bring in social media to that, because we now have... At this whole time, we're criticizing newsrooms, publisher decisions, what turns ad rev, who owns it, what sort of incentive structures exist that might prevent, you know, copying a profit hit, copying a rating hit in order to give more sober coverage that's more helpful to the overall narrative. But now we have algorithms, which are programmed by people to get as many eyeballs as possible. And now we have the algorithm is the publisher now, and it gives even less shits to what's accurate, what's true, what's important. And the algorithm will just boost stuff from regular people, from bot farms, from whatever it is, mix it all in together and be like, you decide. And that, honestly, just being on social media at the moment for me is just, when I approach social media, when I just see, like, you read a comment, you're like, what an absolute idiot. Like, part of me just goes, probably a bot. And that helps me manage just thinking humanity's a bunch of idiots. Instead, I go, nah, all the humans I meet in real life are awesome. I bet these guys are bots or people, just whatever it is. And that helps me. But now we've got this space online where it almost doesn't matter what the news covers, because now we've got, whether it's, you know, individuals just spraying information, then we've got bot farms spraying information, then we've got politicians with political agendas spraying information. And so it's almost as if I can see the media just kind of in that article where the ABC goes, here's everything we know. I can imagine in the room, they're sitting there going, normally we don't do this, but everyone's saying it's this poor bloke in the middle of nowhere. So we want to put it out so that people at least have one verified source of information, so that when they see online that it was so-and-so and he went so-and-so and it was a target of this and it was an inside job and there was this cosplay actor pretending to be injured, like, oh my gosh, the amount of people that sent me that. I can almost see, it's like, I don't know, I'm just depressed at looking at the introduction of social media to this already thing that we seem to have failed at. Before social media was around, it sounds to me like we already failed, and now we've just literally poured rocket fuel on it. So even if the media did everything you're talking about, algorithms are just like, they're just going to fill the void, and they have, even with media outlets doing whatever they do for views. I don't know. Go where you want with that. Right.
Let me say three things to that, because it's a really important question. And your example of the ABC there, which is why I'm trying not to be critical of humans in this. I'm trying to talk about the structures and the ideas and the evidence, yep. And that's what we do. Number one, the people that have taken control of social media. So social media was created, and then what we've seen, and this was not organic, this was not in capitalism, this was just behemoths who swallow everything. They're ideological, they're supported, and they become richer and richer and richer. And what are all these billionaires doing? They're buying methods of communication. Hello, what we do matters, right? They are buying the way that we talk to each other. They are some of the worst dudes on the planet. Like, let's be really clear that these are terrible people who do terrible things for terrible reasons. And we're allowed to say that, and we're allowed to acknowledge that we probably don't want them determining everything to do with our lives. And if we are on social media, and you're right, you know, are people really saying that? By the way, a lot of it isn't real. You know, yeah. We've discovered just how many bot farms there are. You know, so we can actually choose to say, okay, most of what I'm seeing here isn't real. So let's really contextualize that. And I think your point about what it says about how divided we are is really important for us to remember, because the more divided we feel, the less safe we are. So number two also means that we should not think that social media is inevitable. Like, we can make changes. We can ask for more. We can ask for better. We introduced an under 16 social media ban here. Now, there's lots of things that I don't agree with, or lots of bit of dodgy bits that talk to me about politicians. They always manage to find a way to do something a bit dodgy and something a bit self-serving. But it shows that it can be done. Remember when Facebook turned off the news in Australia because they were pissed with us?
So they don't want to pay tax or whatever it is.
Right. But they were like, they were able to say no news, but only for Australia. So within those keystrokes, there are outcomes that are different. So it's not inevitable for us to sit and say, yeah, you know what? Do better. And the third thing, therefore, really becomes, from a media perspective, do we lead or do we follow? And my view is we lead. And what we do is say, because if people on social media, and on Sunday was a good example, I've seen this thing, I'm going to offer my hot take, hateful opinion, or I'm going to amplify something that's not true, and I'm going to do it fast, and I don't care, well, then we kind of led that charge, didn't we? Like, we prioritized speed over verification. We prioritized sensational. So they did learn that from us, so they can unlearn it from us. When 24-hour TV news started launching in the 1990s, and Sky News was sort of at the forefront of speed and spectacle, their unofficial motto, very well known within our industry, was always first and never wrong for long. And that was the way that the culture we saw in the 90s developed, you know, always first, never wrong for long. And that was their unofficial motto. And it really showed you now where we're at 30 years later, right? Because what we see is everyone wants to be first. No one even gives a shit whether they're wrong or not. They just want to be first. So we are responsible for creating a culture like that. And we can take that back. And we can say, actually, truth, the news, society is worth more than that. And as soon as we do that, you watch us demand. You watch us demand that social media do better. But right now, we don't. We just say, how do we be part of this ecosystem? How do we make sure our social media presence aligns up to that? And then aligned to that, and I think this has certainly happened in the last few years in particular, is that the news has it needs to be the baseline for truth. Like, we have to have something that's real. And it's really struggled with that in the last few years. It's really struggled with that. And I've sat there in horror, you know, as I've watched news lose its baseline of truth. Because if we lose that baseline of truth, then what we do is create the vacuum that we're seeing where nothing matters anymore. It's all just politics. And I, you know, I don't know how many of you have read 1984, you know, the great George Orwell book. Let me give you the primer. It ain't about CCTV cameras. Like, there are CCTV cameras in there. Sure. That's not what the book's about. You know what the book's about? If your party, if your tribe says 2 + 2 = 5, then it's 5. That's it. It's about loyalty to your political ideology over truth itself. That is what that whole book is warning against. And that is, I know we overdo this whole dystopian thing, but we've never done it like this before. And because we've really lost our baseline of truth in our society, everyone now just views everything through their tribe, through their politics, and they say, my side is true and your side is false, even when you're saying the same damn things. That is how we become divided. That is what social media is doing for us. We can and we must, within news, reestablish ourselves as the beacon of truth, and as consumers, respect it, understand it, reward it, and also take responsibility and recognize our agency post an event like Bondi to say what we do matters, what we share matters, what we ask of our leaders matters. And like I was saying before, you know, that idea of punters politics in the pub where you say, well, what do we agree on as a baseline of democracy? I bet it's all the same stuff. And then the politics is just, yeah, you think this of immigration and I think this of immigration. You think we should be doing a bit more on this on the environment and I think we should be doing this on the environment. We can get to that once we've established stop stealing from us, stop lying to us, stop buying shares or insider, all the crap, stop hiding your documents, stop it. We all agree on that. And if we agree on that better, and if we drive that change, then surely we'll get better politicians. And if we do, we can surely start seeing more considered responses to these big questions. I genuinely believe that's possible.
I think when I look at that, and I want to come to solutions in a minute around media and social media, but when I look at how media operates now and my cynical take on it, it's very easy for Aussies to be cynical. When I talk to regular punters around politics and around media, the easiest conclusion we can go to, and I go there as well, where it's like all politicians are the same. They're all the bloody same, so it doesn't matter. And there's an element of truth to that, because I do point out the ways in which they are bloody identical, the ways in which they take the same money, the ways in which they are the same, but then there's obviously very real tangible ways in which this will actually give you better tangible outcomes than this party or this politician. Mm. And this politician is way more corrupt than this politician, and this politician took worse money than this politician. But it's really hard, as far as I've seen it, for we regular punters to just see the variance in corruption. We kind of, the easiest thing, we don't have time to nitpick and measure and weigh. We just kind of go, all right, they're all the same. And I think we do the same with media. We look at media and we go, oh, well, they're all just lying to us anyway because they omitted this. They didn't tell us that. They exaggerated this. But it's not equally the same as a bot farm out of Vietnam that is paid to just go, oh, crisis where? Do, 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 do. Amp up the AI bot, out come the things, and Aussies just go, oh, bloody no way. Oh, share, 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 which many of us do. And so when we look at the media, the narrative that bothers me so much around media in Australia is we're always having a cry about it. Oh, poor media can't get enough money. Oh, journalists are losing their jobs because we're all watching Netflix and not watching the news and no one watches TV anymore. And poor Harvey Norman can't show his ads and he was the guy that funded it before. And that's always bothered me because from where I sit, Rupert Murdoch doesn't own all the media in Australia to make money, not directly. He owns it because he has shares in other companies, adjacent companies, gas companies. Kerry Stokes owns a gas mine. He deliberately doesn't cover certain stories, and it's a weapon to use against politicians. We want you to do the social media ban. You better do it. We don't want you to do the gambling ban. If you do it, we might be critical. This is what corporate media, in my summation, has become. And so when I hear you say, like, how does our media lead again? I can understand how publications like the ABC can do that because they're not taking corporate money. They're taxpayer funded. And so I can see how, for me, I'm like, I can believe that. But I just don't, I don't see a pathway in which Kerry Stokes and Rupert Murdoch and all the shareholders get together and go, we know that the research indicates that our coverage of these events increases the likelihood of another mass shooting happening. Yeah. However, we operate in the vague ways we do with this veneer of legitimacy when really the shareholder will get the last say. Like, we won't run that story if this advertiser is a big advertiser because we just implicitly know they're not going to like that. So we're not going to do it. And what we're asking of our corporate media machine is to look at their entire business model and go and essentially say to us, we exist for you, Australians. We exist to tell you what's real. We exist to build a society and a shared universe of facts that matter and a shared universe of how our society functions. And that will come at the cost of media ceasing to be what media currently is, in what I think. And what media currently is a tool for a small group of shareholders to control our politicians. And they'd have to essentially let that go. Now, am I being too cynical, conspiratorial? Tell me.
So I think it's so interesting that people really understand that this is not a natural progression. A lot of people spent a lot of time and a lot of money to make it like this. So we had different laws. So when journalism was first sort of created, like the 1930s, the government sat down and went, what is this thing? So they created, all right, we need a not-for-profit model. Got to have a not-for-profit model, ABC. We need diversity. So let's have commercial model. Let's have newspapers and radios differently. And they specifically wrote these rules. And the rules were like, one person can't own everything. That clearly wouldn't be journalism. And that was it. It was right like that. Done. I have this video of Rupert Murdoch from about 1966 making a cup of tea. Dude always looked 100. He's making a cup of tea. And I don't know why people spoke so differently in the 1960s. Like, well, it's not a perfect model, well, you know. Can you think of a better one? And he's like, the important thing is that one person doesn't own everything and bully the population. That's how I think journalism should work. And you know what, 1966 Rupert Murdoch? I agree with you. So we actually undid the laws. And they actively did it. So it was Malcolm Fraser and it was Bob Hawke. So it was bipartisan because anybody who studies politics knows all the best bastardry is actually bipartisan. Malcolm Fraser, then Rupert Murdoch went to Bob Hawke and went, change the laws. Let me own more. I'll be really nice to the Labour Party. And then they changed it again in the 90s. Then they changed it again in about 2018 and we lost Fairfax. You know, the oldest news organisation in Australia was sold to Channel 9. People sat in rooms and undid these rules. Okay. So where we're at now is the result of people working really, really hard. And now we sit here and say, oh, it's too hard to change. I'm like, no, it's not. We changed it. So Tom Stoppard started his life as a local journalist. And he said, if you want to change the world, if you want to make the world a better place, journalism is still the fastest way to do that. And he's right. So let's fix the laws. Let's fix the media ownership laws. Let's help commercial news outlets have a business model that helps them survive without them relying on advertising all the time. Because Google and Facebook and Meta make more from advertising than every news outlet in the world combined. And they did that about 7 years ago. So now it would be, you know, so it's just the wrong model. So change the ownership laws, change the business model. If that sounds hard, then I promise you that has already been done to make everything worse. So we're just saying, oh, it's easy to make worse, but it's hard to make better. And I'm like, I don't accept that. What we have are the kinds of politicians who will not tackle that, who will refuse to tackle that because they don't want to take them on. And that's where you see the vicious circle. All you got to do is just pop that circle. We have a saying in Ireland that I think is always relevant in times like these. It's like, oh, Glyn, how do you get to Kinnegoo Bay? I said, well, it's easy to get to Kinnegoo Bay as long as you're not starting from here. And that's what media in this country is. It's actually easy to fix, but where it's put us is hard. It feels we're stuck in the mud and it's hard to get out of. It isn't. I promise the answers aren't that hard. And countries who have better democracies than we do, better standards of living than we do, follow better journalism models, better business models. They do not have the same problems in that sense than we do. So really important, like I was saying about social media, that we don't see it as inevitable and impossible to fix and something that only other people can talk about. These dudes worked so hard over decades to undo all the good laws about journalism. And because they weren't great dudes, when the internet came in and all the digital disruption, they just didn't handle it very well. They seemed to be pretty bad at business from my point of view, because they were like, oh, no, no, we'll still rely on selling adverts. It's like, is anybody in the room saying that that's not going to fly? Like, there's got to be a better way. So just sit down and sort your shit out, because we can and we should.
The one thing that changes a politician's willingness to take on something difficult, which this is difficult because it goes against Uncle Rupert and it goes against Mr. Stokes, who control the media, who then control what politicians do, because they say, wink, wink, nudge, nudge to the politician, you do this, it hurts my profits, I will run endless stories against you. And guess what? Aussies will believe it. I think I'm always looking at it going, I'll believe shit all the time that I don't know about. And I think Aussies, we just need to admit, propaganda works. I've bought so many useless shit on Facebook and I know it's on Facebook and it's some drop shipping something and I get the product and it sucks and I do it all the time and I'm like, I'm an idiot. And I think that coming to understand that propaganda works, so have respect for its power. Murdoch and the billionaires we always talk about that control the media, Zuckerberg, they're very smart. They know what they're doing. They know how manipulated we can be because it's called advertising. They wouldn't advertise if it didn't work. And the one thing that can kind of circumvent all this stuff is when there is everyone focusing on the one thing politically. Politicians can't hide. They will eventually look at the power that the billionaire wields through his media machine and go, no, 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 no. People are really angry about this. I'm going to leave them for a second and do what these massive group of people want because I can't get away with it anymore. So it seems to me when everyone is focused on the right things and focused on these structures, there are actually simple solutions. Like I used to teach grade 10 economics to kids. And one of the concepts I came in the textbook, I was just flicking through. I'm like, oh, externalities. Why do I never hear any politicians talk about externalities? Externalities, for anyone listening, is the unintended consequences of a business or a person or someone doing something. If you start a business upstream and it creates, you know, bed sheets and they put the dye into the river, the externality is everyone dying from drinking blue dye in the river, right? That's the externality that comes out. And so when I look at these sorts of things, we've dealt with a lot of pollution externalities in society. And what we're talking about now here is the pollution externality of our media and our media structures and big tech and algorithms. They are having very real consequences in direct or indirect ways that can cause or exacerbate a really bad situation. And there are ways to kind of mitigate that. Taxes is one of them. You could, I've got an idea to fund these new media organizations. How about we have a big tech tax? $1 trillion corporations, almost $1 trillion, $1 billion, and they're coming in here, they're not paying tax. We can make them pay something and then use that money to help our society navigate what is true and what is not. Like, you're right, there are kind of simple solutions that are right there, but it is hard to believe in them when we're not looking at the right things.
So I think that it's a really important lesson for us all, in the simplest terms, is to make sure we separate the word democracy from the word politics, right? They're two different things. Politics is how we enact our democracy. There's the decisions we make about what we, how we want to make our democracy work. So as a rule, I hate politics. I hate it. I love democracy. And I don't think enough people talk about what that means. I think democracy is the best thing we ever did for ourselves, right? We have the right to self-determination. And that is, in the entire history of humanity, very new. If you think that's important, if you think it's important that we get to choose our leaders, that we don't have kings and dictators and despots and dipshits, if you think that's important, act like it. That's it. Act like it. And that means demand the laws that stop the corruption. Demand that laws that stop the lobbying and the constant rotation of politician to lobbyist to politician to lobbyist, the backroom deals, the sordid shit that we are supposed to just put up with. And within that, if you say democracy matters and act like it, then it's obvious how you should be treating the fourth estate. It is a pillar of democracy. It is designed to help us be informed and engaged. It's an idea that's been around since democracy was invented in ancient Greece. They used to say, if people get to vote, but they don't know what's going on, like if they're not informed about what's happening, then inevitably it will lead to tyranny. That's what they used to say 2,500 years ago. If you don't know what's happening, then absolutely bad things will come.
Because it sounds to me like our power as a democratic population, people who have a say in who our leaders are, seems to be entirely dependent on what we focus on, which is why we're coming back to media in this, is because they are the determinant of what is our reality. And when I hear the social media conversation sort of come up, I think the under 16 social media ban is a great example of that. Is it great to see the government actually has balls and can stand up to the world's biggest companies? Yes. They pass a law, it happened. Will it work? We'll see. You know, jury's out. So I liked seeing that. But also the conversation around, oh, like we want to protect young people, that'd be really great, but do nothing on gambling ads. So it's what we focus on is always an interesting thing. And when it comes to social media, the conversation goes, misinformation. We'll blame the person that did it. Well, it's a bot farm somewhere else. Oh, but how do we do it? Big tech's like, it's too hard. We've got $1 trillion, but can't possibly imagine how to work out which activity's coming from Vietnam and Bangladesh and bot farms out of Russia. Like, oh no, like it's too hard. And we believe it. And they go, let's crack down. And the government goes, what's the easier way? It's easy to crack down on our own population. It's easy to monitor what everyone's saying. It's easier to arrest someone for something they might have said online, like outrageous as it might be. Let's try and play whack-a-mole with individual misinformation. And then big tech gets to sit back and go, oh, great. We don't have to show anyone what's in our algorithm. We don't have to be responsible for the publishing decisions that we outsource to an algorithm. We are not responsible in any way. Let's make the government police its citizens and leave us alone and leave us to make millions. I think it just came out Facebook made a couple $1 billion or whatever from known scams running on their platform, right? There's no incentive for them to get rid of that. They made heaps of money, right? So long way of kind of saying my point is our power is in what we focus on. So bringing it to you and you thinking about mass shootings, media, when people are looking at what to focus on, what do you think some solutions we can look for or push for or suggest or talk about that might begin to take steps in the direction that we're talking about?
Tough question. So when I was writing the book, a line came to me and I ended up using it a few times. I'd never used it before. Society understands itself through the stories it chooses to tell. That's how we understand ourselves. That's how we think who we are. Which stories are we choosing to tell? When you work in a field like journalism, the only insult that Rupert Murdoch ever made of us at the ABC that I think is perfectly, I don't think it's an insult, I think it's actually, but I think it's valid, is that it's elitist. All journalism is elitist. Why? Because it's powerful. Because you get to contribute to the stories that we are choosing to tell. And when we started this conversation, you talked about your sense of responsibility that you felt as someone with a platform. That is where we start. That word responsibility and how we think about the stories we are choosing to tell. In a mass shooting, I'm choosing to tell the story of Matilda. I'm choosing to believe, to follow Matilda's father, who says, remember her name. I will. I'll remember that name. I'm choosing to tell the story of Ahmed al-Ahmed. I'm choosing to tell the story of Sophia and Boris German and all of those incredible people who, in the worst moment, the unimaginably worst moment of their lives, did something unimaginably heroic. And I'm choosing to say the people who committed this crime will not get from me what they seek. A, because that feels better. It does. It feels better when we don't give them the thing that they're looking for. And B, because I understand as a citizen of a democracy that I can actually contribute to this not happening again. I can contribute to this not happening again by the stories I choose to share and tell on my social media and in my conversations, by the media I access, by the demands I make of the media that I access and the demands I make of the people who are paid to lead. And I see so much more leadership from our community leaders. You know, I think some of the Jewish and Islamic leaders have been incredibly eloquent and powerful at this time. And I've not necessarily seen as much of that from politicians as I would like. So I know which one I think I feel more inspired by. So I think that that's where I would be saying, you know, we understand ourselves by the stories we choose to tell. So let's tell the right ones.
I think that's really helpful for us to know where we sit and how we can contribute to that conversation in a positive way. Because we all, like, yes, we are one like and one share. But my whole platform is, like, when people denigrate that, like, I'm torn, because individual responsibility is what large corporations do to avoid legislative accountability that can change the game rapidly and instantly to benefit everybody else. But then also, at the same time, what you do does matter. And my whole platform is built off the fact that regular punters were outraged with the stuff I was talking about and said, people need to know about this. And now politicians know my name because of them, because they shared it, because they liked it. So it was one like, it was one share. And that is why I am where I am. And so I can appreciate that and what we share and what we like and what stories we choose to tell. What legislation would you like to see? You're talking to a politician, you've got a silver bullet, you've only got the one silver bullet in the chamber. What's that piece of legislation that you want to start that domino effect with? Obviously, there's lots of things, but where would you choose to start based on where you're sitting?
100% media ownership laws. What is journalism is everything, because that then becomes, we re-engage our baseline of truth. We re-engage the idea of what news is for.
To what? What do you imagine it being and the government kind of mandating?
Oh, like if we started with them undoing all the laws they changed, we'd be in a much better place, right?
Yeah, like media diversity, ownership, exactly. Like consolidation of ownership. Yeah.
Together. So, you know, it is not controversial for me to say that Channel 9 shouldn't own the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. They should be separate. Channel 9 shouldn't own all those radio stations. They should be separate. That's three separate media organizations. Okay. And then if they're well supported and their job is to be different and engage their audiences, and then they've got sustainable, you know, business models and revenue raising to do it, then that's made our ecosystem three times better straight away. And it's not an insult to any of them to say that. That's what media diversity is all about. So just making that a very ethical and sustainable and diverse environment, again, as it used to be, would inevitably make politics better in this country tomorrow. Yeah.
Glenn, thanks so much for the extensive chat. Is there anything else you might have missed you want to add, or you're pretty...
Look, find me online. You know, I've written articles for Fairfax and for Crikey, which is a great independent news organization. They're out there.
Glenn, thanks so much for joining the Punters on the Punters Politics podcast.
Take it easy.